ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Robin Williams here. I've been bringing you The Science Show for 50 years, somehow.
And I'm Belinda Smith, the host of Lab Notes, the brand new sister show that gives you the latest discoveries in under 15 minutes.
Between us, we love all of science, old and new.
So whether you've got an hour or just a quarter of one,
we've got science covered. To hear us, search for The Science Show,
where you'll find both Lab Notes and Science Show. Go check it out.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The School of Anthropology at the University of Sydney, the oldest in the nation, is celebrating its centenary. Its work has shaped how we see this country and its peoples, but more so than ever, the uses and misuses of anthropology is an issue of concern well beyond academia. Later, anthropology here after 100 years. We'll also hit the streets of Chicago, where the good citizens of that town are turning on Trump's immigration enforcement agents, the men of ICE, who've spent a couple of months rounding up anyone they suspect of living without papers in the USA. The campaign against ICE is bringing the people onto the streets. But first, to the United Kingdom. 11 years since a Florida court heard he had sex with Virginia Jeffrey, aged 17. 10 years since a photograph of him appeared with his arms around the woman. 6 years since Jeffrey claimed he in fact raped her 3 times. And 10 days after the publication of Jeffrey's ghosted memoir, Nobody's Girl, the heat is on Prince Andrew to disappear, and for the monarchy perhaps to follow. Ian Dunt of the iPaper is here with the latest. Ian, how is the monarchy holding out?
Well, the monarchy itself is fine, really. I mean, there's no significant change in the manner in which it's viewed. But you can see the monarchy manages to endure because it is pretty good at spotting dangers before it gets to the point where, you know, they're affecting its credibility. The only gap there was during the death of Princess Diana, where things were so sort of fevered and hysterical that really they lost control of the narrative and they were in genuine danger at that moment. They very rarely are, and they're not now. But you can see why they're concerned. I mean, just a few hours ago, I was about to still call him Prince Charles. King Charles was out and about on a visit where one solitary protester sort of jumped up and started shouting about Andrew, why he was still being given money, why Parliament wasn't talking about it. The crowd then intervened and started, you know, 3 cheers for the king and blah, blah, blah. And that gives you a pretty good sort of distillation of where we're at, you know, in terms of the broad public view of the monarchy, unchanged. But this sudden sense of uncertainty and volatility, particularly around this issue.
Will Andrew lose his home?
You're right. The imaginatively titled Royal Lodge, which is where he lives, with a sort of peppercorn token rent. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that something along those lines is going to happen. I mean, this is now, you're starting to hear questions from people like the Prime Minister. You're starting to hear questions in Parliament. You're starting to see that kind of sort of really quite bludgeoning press coverage day after day of front page headlines, zero tolerance really for any kind of moderation towards him whatsoever. And this is the current issue that it's mostly focused on. Like, will he be able to keep the Royal Lodge that he lives in? I think increasingly the answer looks like no, although the mechanisms by which you achieve that are quite hard to see. Ultimately, it would depend on the royal family probably taking action themselves.
So this is a big White House, 30 rooms in Windsor Great Park. I think under the flight path for Heathrow, isn't it? Not perhaps as attractive as some might think. They've been trying to get him out of there for years, but Fergie lives there as well, which is sweet. And I've read reports, I don't know whether, Ian, these are true, that Fergie might accept shifting to somewhere called Adelaide Cottage, and Andrew might find himself somewhere called Frogmore Cottage in the same Windsor Great Park.
Yeah, these are these sort of, I mean, I suppose they'd be basically sort of hermitages within, you know, a larger royal estate, and that they would then be able to sort of be tucked out of the way there physically in the same way that they have been tucked out of the way symbolically. His case has not been helped by the publication of photos showing Epstein at that lodge, along with Weinstein. So it's almost like this sort of like league of the most sort of villainous figures of the last 10 years. And that makes the situation very, very hard to pertain. Like the royal family so far has managed to limit the damage by basically saying that we're just going to take away your ability to use your royal titles. He puts out a statement, Andrew puts out a statement saying, well, look, I mean, I've decided to do this of my own accord. I don't think anyone's under any illusions as to how that conversation would have gone or how much he genuinely chose to do it. Clearly, it's being forced on him. And at this stage now, there is quite evidently a lookout for what kind of, you know, housing situation can we just dump him in to take him out of the limelight to stop him being such a problem.
I think they're going to have to take the garter robes off him too, aren't they? I mean, that's just horrible. But the great embarrassment is family occasions, isn't it? I mean, state occasions, yes, they can keep him in a cupboard. But for christenings and weddings and funerals, there he is. He's so unattractive, Ian. He's such... It shouldn't count, should it? But yes, it shouldn't count. But you've written in the iPaper the other day that... This is not evidence of any kind of argument for getting rid of the monarchy in Britain.
No, it isn't. There's no popular support for that position. And nothing has really changed in terms of the reason why it's kept. The arguments for getting rid of it have always been quite weak. I mean, they're progressive arguments. The weakest one of all of them is the question of priorities. Of just like, you know, there is just so much that is dreadfully wrong in this country. You wouldn't even put the monarchy in the top 40 of things that drastically need changing. Predominantly, it doesn't really have any meaningful form of executive power. And while that pertains, you're obviously going to concern yourself much more with institutions which do have executive power and which have performed in an abysmal way over, well, not just the last 10 years, but much longer than that. So firstly, there's the question of priority. But secondly, I have to say, is a larger question, which I think, you know, from an Australian perspective, is quite interesting and quite telling, which is really what happens if you get rid of it, which of course was the, you know, which is what floundered during the referendum that you guys had on this issue. It wasn't so much, do you want to keep it? I didn't get the impression that people in Australia did particularly want to keep it. It was more, is there any support for an alternative system?
And what sort of system do you have?
Well, exactly. And then the question is, okay, fine. So it's going to be democratic. Okay. Well, what happens then? And I mean, certainly in Britain right now, what happens then is that the head of state role would be sucked into the monstrous values-based culture war that we have everywhere else. It would be Nigel Farage for the reactionary right versus, you know, Green leader Zach Polanski for the sort of populist left shouting at each other about, you know, is immigration good or bad? And that would be the replacement. And the truth is, no matter where people are on that conversation or whether they're in it at all, they look at it and think, well, you know what, I wouldn't mind just having a sort of politics-free monarchy, even if it is on this insane ancient vestige of bloodline, rather than having that kind of bun fight. And on that basis, that question of what you replace it with, that's typically where any kind of conversations about republicanism just shatter on the shore.
Ian, just consider for a moment that we are commemorating the 50th anniversary of an incident where the Governor-General sacked an elected Prime Minister in this country with some considerable cooperation from Buckingham Palace. So your notion that, you know, there is no executive power, perhaps not in the United Kingdom, but we're rougher out here. And that notion of, you know, deeply held monarchical power satisfies the imaginations of many Australians. But look, let's leave the monarchy for a moment, secure and able, and turn to Tory immigration policy. They really have brought honour on themselves, haven't they, with this new immigration policy?
It's almost, I mean, what's extraordinary about it is it's almost like they don't even know that they've done it. Well, in fact, they don't know that they've done it because we've seen, you know, there's conversations now with the leader of the Conservative Party and the spokesperson for the leader of the Conservative Party, and indeed the Shadow Home Secretary, where they show a deep ignorance as to the bill that they themselves have published and put in the public domain. It is by far the most, I mean, well beyond anything that the British National Party, a fascist party in the 1990s, was putting forward, much more extreme than that. The bill that they put forward earlier in the summer and only recently really discovered essentially says that people who have already been granted indefinite leave to remain, in other words, who have satisfied the legal requirements and have been allowed to stay here for as long as they like, essentially the step before citizenship, will now be deported if we decide that retrospectively they have broken conditions which we are currently going to apply but did not apply at the time that they were breaking them. Among those are, have they ever claimed any kind of benefit, including child maintenance payments, which, by the way, are basically given out to almost everyone in this country, and including state pension, which again would be above the level that they discuss. Have they been out of work and earning less than a certain amount for over 6 months? These criterias would see millions of deportations. And deportations, not just as, you know, people think of, even think of as immigrants, but people who are basically British families. You know, the spouses of British partners, British children themselves. You'd be tearing apart families and deporting them. It is much more extreme than what Donald Trump has been pursuing in the US, because at least ostensibly, those ICE quasi-military raids are against people who've broken immigration rules. They're not de facto charges against people who were legal migrants. And it is also much more extreme quantitatively than what Idi Amin did in Uganda, where the numbers were well below the millions that are being discussed here. Now, having written this bill, the Conservatives now seem almost shocked at the extent of what they themselves have proposed and seemingly now deny having written it, but they did write it. And it gives you an indication of just how corrosive that conversation has become in Britain.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister seems to have loser tattooed on his forehead.
I mean, that's, it's a very brutal description, but it's not necessarily an incorrect one. Coming in at 11% in the Caerphilly by-election last week, a by-election in Wales. Wales is the proper homeland of Labour. It's, you know, where some of the most famous figures in Labour history, including Nye Bevan, the creator of the NHS, and Neil Kinnock, former leader of the Labour Party, have come from. Absolutely hammered to 11% in a race that was won, fascinatingly, by Plaid Cymru. Plaid Cymru, a Welsh independence party that wants to separate from the UK. Welsh independence has never had very much success in Wales or anywhere else.
It's a great issue. I mean, for Wales to reclaim its nationhood after how many centuries? But anyway, we'll look more closely into that in a moment. This little corner of Wales, a Labour stronghold, held for more than a century by Labour. Very, very white. Yeah. A former coal mining area. And now they've turned to Welsh independence.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I don't think that that's happened. I think what's happened here is an astonishing speed of change in two-party politics, from Labour against the Conservatives to Reform against Plaid Cymru. Now, Reform, it's that hard right party led by Nigel Farage, very anti-immigration. And once it's talked about more often, and it is the centre of almost all political conversations over here right now, the great populist wave at the gates, the barbarians at the gates, then what happens is the progressive forces are just consolidating around whoever there is to go to. The crucial thing to look at is, it's not just the Labour vote. Look at the Green vote in that seat, down to 1.5%. Look at the Liberal Democrat vote in that seat, down to 1.5%. Look at the Tory vote when you look at the consolidation of the right-wing vote, down to 2%. What's happening there is essentially Reform voters who really like them flooding to the party on the populist right, and progressive voters going for anyone who can defeat them. And suddenly, with astonishing speed, Labour and the Conservatives, who have owned politics for over 100 years, I mean, the Conservatives, but, you know, centuries before that, suddenly being replaced by these new brands. In different seats, it obviously won't be Plaid Cymru. It'll be the Green Party that can consolidate, or it'll still be Labour, it'll still be the Lib Dems. But suddenly you're getting this insight into a very different, very new kind of British politics fought by different parties on completely new terrain.
And in less than a minute, can you explain what Sir Keir Starmer plans to do about it?
No, I don't think I can. I don't think anyone knows at this point. he does some things that are terribly wonderful. He did a great conference speech, you know, a few weeks ago, calling out Reform for being racist. Then the rest of the time, he'll come out and equivocate and sort of justify some of these extremist policies that we see from Reform. I don't think they have a narrative or a strategy. And, you know, things would significantly improve if they did. I cannot stress enough how urgent it is that they do so.
Ian, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
You're wonderful. Ian Dunt, columnist with iPaper, with the iPaper, recently slightly renamed, co-host of the Origin Story podcast. Thanks so much for being on the show once again. Coming up, Chicago takes on ICE. In Chicago, neighbors text neighbors, ICE is here. Masked and armed in unmarked trucks and even helicopters, immigration and customs enforcement agents have descended on another apartment block, a school, a worksite, a supermarket, to round up anyone they suspect of being an immigrant without papers. Suspicion is enough. The Supreme Court has said looking Latino can see you thrown in detention. But the citizens of Chicago, those alert neighbours, are taking ICE on, keeping watch for patrols, honking and whistling to warn locals that they're about, filming arrests and running hotlines for families torn apart by arrests. Evelyn Vargas is a member of a group called Organised Communities Against Deportation, OCAD. These days, she's coordinating the Chicago Area Community Watch on ICE. Evelyn, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me here.
How bad has it been in Chicago for the last couple of months?
It's been really intense, especially for our community members who are too worried about going to work, too worried about taking their children to school, worried about taking the bus. I think every aspect of regular life has been infiltrated by fear.
Has it been more intense in the last couple of months? There's been a special operation, hasn't there, in Chicago?
Yes. Midway Blitz, which is an initiative that ICE, along with the Trump administration, are carrying out here in Chicago and the Chicagoland area to arrest and detain and kidnap as many people who look brown or who sound like they speak Spanish as possible. And it's been incredibly intense since the start of September. I don't think we've ever seen numbers like these. It wasn't that long ago, I want to say 3 weeks ago, that we got 1,000 calls in a single day, which is the most that we've ever seen at one time. And that's just part of the folks that call us concerned that ICE is around the corner or ICE has detained their loved one.
Tell us about your organization.
Yeah, so I'm with Organized Communities Against Deportation, and we've been around since 2013, even longer with our work. And what we do is we have started pushing against the systems that ICE has to try and repatriate the folks that have come to make Chicago their home and their community. And what we have found out is that ICE has an incredible amount of discretion on who they do and do not deport. So we have really worked within the system and through informal channels to ensure that our communities don't get deported.
It's interesting you say that you've been around since 2013. Now, this long predates Donald Trump. ICE has been around even longer, has it not?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people are kind of concerned, even in Chicago, about what's going on in terms of the immigration system, kind of for the first time. And it's been something that's been it's been on a lot of people's radar, and that it is causing grave concern around what it looks like when people can't find their loved ones and they're kidnapped, or what it looks like when someone is in detention for months on end, or what it looks like when a family member gets detained and they're the primary breadwinner and can't provide for the rest of their family. But this has been true for as long as the immigration system has been in place. And so what OCAD is really trying to call attention to is not that it is particularly bad now, which it is, but that this system is meant to work in this way and is working in this way blatantly.
There's a suggestion in a recent issue of Atlantic magazine that OCAD is fashioning its strategies in some ways on the Black Panthers.
So what we really have done, and it's more that the Black Panthers had this system of police vigilance that they used to make sure that the community was safe. Because again, what OCAD does is work in through informal and formal channels to ensure that our communities are safe. And what that means for us as an abolitionist organization is that we don't believe the police do that. And so what the Black Panthers were able to have, this system of vigilance, had continued in the Bay Area, in that area of California, well into the 90s. And so when our organizers saw that that was occurring, we were able to get trained on what it means to do collective safety, because that ultimately, that's the message that we want to get across, that the community saves the community at the end of the day. It's not the police and it's not ICE.
Who is the community that is now emerging that's willing to look after the targets of ICE? Is it just the immigrant community itself?
No, it's folks from everywhere. We've got teachers, we've got attorneys, we have researchers, we have stay-at-home parents, and those are the folks that do anything from helping us get social media going so that people are alerted through WhatsApp or Facebook. We've got folks who do research and are cataloging anytime we've heard of a detention and mapping out where it is that our loved ones have been abducted. And we've got folks, a lot of folks, spread across the Chicagoland area in 29 groups responding to incidents where folks have been detained and taken. And they're there documenting, they're there giving Know Your Rights information, they're there canvassing to make sure that the rest of the folks who are less vulnerable know that they're not alone.
White folks as well as Hispanics?
Yes, it's a lot. It's been nice and great to see that solidarity. And we've really seen a lot of our white allies come to figure out in different ways and how they can support, and even taking initiatives of their own. But I think even better than that, it's been so pleasant to see a change of pace where there's this, I think usually traditionally there's been a lot of advocacy going on where there is one group speaking on behalf of the other group. And this time, I think we're seeing more and more instances of the brown community taking lead and white folks really saying, okay, what is it that you need? How can I best fit in? And that's been really great to see.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Evelyn Vargas from OCAD, Organized Communities Against Deportation, in the city of Chicago. Evelyn, what happens when OCAD gets a call to say that an ICE raid is going on? How do you respond?
When an ICE raid comes, it comes through our hotline, and we've got a bunch of folks who are directly impacted, immigrants answering this hotline, and the folks that anyone can call in. And so when it's a call about someone being abducted, we will then dispatch the closest neighborhood group. And those neighborhood groups are formed, they're either volunteer and autonomous, or they're based in an organization. And so these are really folks giving their time and volunteering and spending something in the middle of their day to go out and check. And often, as we see the risk increase, put themselves at risk for anything from physical harm to being detained for a period of time. So a group will go out, often two or more, and we try to get there within 10 minutes of when the incident was called in. And it can really range. Sometimes we get there after the incident has happened. And it could be that folks are shaken up and they need to be spoken about around who the person was. And people are so wonderful about talking with us, even when they're nervous. Sometimes we get there afterward. Recently, not that long ago, one of our team members responded to a husband and wife that was abducted, and they left the wife go because they have a daughter at school. And the wife didn't know where to go, if she could go home, what to think, what she tell her daughter. And our rapid responder was able to show up to speak with her and give her all of that information. And sometimes it gets really intense. Sometimes these agents are throwing out gas bombs with tear gas and rubber bullets, which are really in difficult canisters. They almost broke a young man's, a 16-year-old's leg the other day, just this past week. It really varies on what our rapid responders show up to see.
And you film these encounters?
We try as much as possible, absolutely, because at this moment in time, this has always been true, but again, it's been more, it hasn't been as blatant, where ICE is working outside of the law and they do not care. And right now we've got this court case that we were able to win, which emphasizes that ICE cannot detain individuals if they don't have a warrant, and they're still doing this. So this detention, these detentions that happen, we want to make sure that they're caught on camera so that those that are detained have a stronger, valid argument, because if it's not caught on tape, it makes it incredibly more difficult for our community members to have a legal case.
But Evelyn, what do you get on tape? You get a man in a mask. Why are they wearing masks? How can, police aren't allowed to wear masks. What's going on here?
I mean, they're doing this to make sure that they can get away with it. Are they, is it, I think the question may be, and I'm not sure if that's like, I think this is might be what you're getting at, is is this for accountability? Is this why we're documenting this? And the answer is no. We don't think that ICE will be able to be accountable for their actions. This isn't something about let's show the world how heinous this is when it is, because this administration is never going to hold their agents accountable of abducting folks and killing people and hurting people's bodies. That's not what we're here for. What we're documenting, what we're getting, is agents working in an illegal fashion to abduct our community so that we, as OCAD, as other groups, as Rapid Response, are able to show this in court and get folks out of detention, because the detention facilities are not meant to hold people, and that they can stay with their families even when their process is moving forward. How they fight their detention, that's a different story. What we also want to show is patterns of how these folks are working so that our community is better informed of how they can keep themselves safe and who to speak with. If we're able to show folks, hey, ICE is breaking windows, is breaking car windows to get into your car and get you out, parents who are driving with children can make better informed decisions. Or honestly, sometimes people choose not to drive at all. So this record that we keep is both for the legal defense of the person that we're supporting and for the protection of our community before the incidents happen. And the fight around deportation defense is something else that we have been struggling for a long time to fight.
The position of lawyers who are helping you, helping OCAD,
helping families who've had somebody put into detention. There was a time when big law firms did a lot of pro bono work on immigration cases. That seems to have dried up.
Yeah, I can't speak for why they did it exactly. My personal guess, and I can only speak for myself, is that it was no longer beneficial for their public image, that they no longer needed to pretend that they cared. And we have, thankfully, partnerships with legal aid organizations who have made it their mission to support the community and who are largely taking the cases that we send their way. But the pro bono work that we had seen coming from law firms, including law firms that we had worked with for years, were no longer doing this, and we're taking that program out from their firms. So we have seen not only an enormous spike in the amount of people needing attorneys and needing attorneys for the most basic things, like locating their loved one, because it's been 2 weeks since they knew anything of their loved one in detention, to fighting their deportation case. And we're seeing less and less law firms giving this legal aid that is so needed to make sure that families are kept together.
The lawyers who are working for you, are they feeling secure?
No, absolutely not. We've seen some of our most admired attorneys get put under scrutiny from the Trump administration. Their legal aid clinics have been taken to court and have been asked to provide documents and to show everything that they've ever done. And that's not because the Trump administration thinks, oh, we know exactly what they've done illegally. It is so that the Trump administration can build a case around this legal aid work that's been happening and push against it and dismantle it. We've seen other individual attorneys be targeted by the Trump administration. Folks are taking down on their pages the staff and the attorneys that work for them so that their faces aren't recognizable. Firms are asking that we only contact them through work phones, no longer individual phones. People are scared, and they're doing this in spite of it because it's the right thing to do.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm speaking to Evelyn Vargas of OCAD, helping immigrants in the Chicago area. Evelyn, there's a particular story that caught my eye, and I thought that it would be good to give a picture of what's going on. The story of Gladys.
Yeah, Gladys is a mom and she came into the U.S. in 2008 from Honduras, and she came and almost right away joined our organization, and she was a single parent and was working to support her three kids. She currently has a daughter in high school who is also answering the hotline with us. So she's both in her studies and taking in these calls of need. And Gladys was able to support us fight not only for her asylum case, but fight for other folks who were in deportation proceedings, showing up to protests for other folks that we were fighting to get liberated and sometimes did, where she would show up to help us share Know Your Rights information to the rest of the community. She wasn't just in this for her own case. She was here because she knew what it meant to work and fight in community. And she was such a beloved member. And in this, during one point of her asylum case, even though her attorneys were working really hard to make sure that it got approved by the court, The government asked her to wear an ankle monitor and to check in with them. And this is something that, as OCAD, we've been wary of for a long time, are the ankle monitors and the phone check-ins that you're supposed to do if they ask you to. And they asked, ICE asked her to come to their office for a check-in. We were very nervous. Her daughter was in finals for school that week, and we weren't, it was just a random text telling her, come to the office. Didn't even give her a time of day. And we get there, and she goes in, and she doesn't come out. And her attorneys are being given the runaround. We don't know how to reach her. She was, it seemed, smuggled through the back door.
Yes.
And we're still fighting to make sure that she can return to her family.
Evelyn, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Evelyn Vargas of OCAD in Chicago about the big ICE operation being mounted in that city now. Coming up, anthropology in Australia, 100 years on. Anthropology is the study of human cultures, usually in the aftermath of conquest. As Claude Levi-Strauss wrote, anthropology is not a dispassionate science like astronomy, which springs from the contemplation of things at a distance. It is the outcome of an historical process which has made the larger part of mankind subservient to the other. Well, the other day, the anthropology department at the University of Sydney, the first in Australia, celebrated its centenary, which provoked a good deal of reflection on the impact of anthropology on Indigenous Australians and how anthropology has influenced the way Australians see themselves. Dr. Michael Edwards is a lecturer in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Sydney and one of the organisers of the centenary bash. And I welcome him now to the show. Michael, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
Now, Michael, imagine Levi-Strauss is your student, okay? What marks out of 10 do you give him for that statement?
I think I'd have to give him an 8 or a 9. It's pretty close to the way that we think about the history of anthropology today, the way in which colonization and empire really created the conditions for anthropology's emergence in the sort of first half of the 20th century.
But we credit, don't we, curiosity, the power of curiosity, the willingness, the wish to know about other cultures. That's all fine, isn't it?
I think that's right, David. And I think, you know, this centenary was an opportunity to reflect on what really is a complex history. And I think that's why I give him an 8 or a 9. I think the colonial piece is a huge piece. And I think for decades, anthropologists have reflected on the ways in which their work, their study of quote unquote other cultures has been implicated in the structures and politics of colonization, including here in Australia. At the same time, there's certainly an argument that there's a much broader definition of anthropology and perhaps a certain tradition of ethnographic curiosity, a desire and a will to know and to understand and to make sense of other cultures that might go far back in human history. You know, anthropologists like to claim figures like Herodotus as some of their forefathers or Ibn Khaldun, the 14th century Arab Muslim scholar, all of whom write about cultures that aren't their own with this kind of ethnographic sensibility. So I think both of these things are in the mix when we think about the history of anthropology today.
It's so fascinating to look at the early colony. And while conquest is going on, there's also curiosity.
Mm.
And we value, don't we,
the results of that curiosity, word lists from the 1820s and you know, descriptions by explorers of the rituals they see, the villages they inhabit. I mean, we honour that even if we're a little bit wary of it, don't we?
I think we do. I think we honour the curiosity that motivates that desire to know, even as we recognise that much of that work took place under some pretty horrific conditions, David. And often what was going on was that these descriptions of other cultures here in Australia with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but right around the world, what was written out of the descriptions of those cultures was the wider context in which that fieldwork took place, which was the colonial context that made the fieldwork possible in the first place.
The colonial quest.
The colonial quest.
To conquer.
Indeed, the colonial quest to conquer and to know, and to know. And
because knowing helped the conquest.
Well, in part. And I think there is an argument that, you know, anthropologists have had complicated relationships, like missionaries, say, with colonial administrators in various parts of the world. You know,
yes.
The British anthropologist Wendy James refers to anthropologists as reluctant imperialists. They are often annoying, actually, to colonial administrators, even as in certain ways they also helped those colonial administrators better understand the native populations that they were supposed to govern. So it's an ambiguous and ambivalent relationship with colonization, I think.
In your talk the other night at the Centenary Bash, you talked about Ralph Piddington and the trouble he caused.
Mm.
Tell us about Ralph Piddington.
Well, I think it's a revealing story because it says as much about what anthropologists do say as what they choose not to say about the silences of anthropology as well. So Piddington studied anthropology and psychology at Sydney University. He went on to a PhD at the London School of Economics, funded with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation of New York, which was funding a lot of anthropology right around the world. Here in Australia, it's a kind of a key part to the story of anthropology's foundation in Australia, as well as what was going on in London. But Piddington, with support of this grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, travels to LaGrange in northwestern Australia and does work with the Gurradjuri people. And in February of 1932, an interview with him is published in what is then a Sydney newspaper, The World, and the headline is Aborigines on Cattle Stations Are in Slavery. And in that interview, Piddington really recounts what he had seen during his fieldwork: slavery, floggings, trafficking, instances of sexual violence as well. And Piddington refers to this as evil. He calls for a government inquiry, and it gets a huge amount, not just of domestic, but also international press.
Because it comes from a scholar?
Because it comes from a scholar, because it breaks the sort of widespread silence on which kind of lays over what much of what's going on in parts of Australia. But it causes controversy. It's entirely rejected by A.O. Neville, who is the chief protector for Aborigines in West Australia at the time. But it also creates a scandal in anthropology, which at that point is really centred around the Sydney department. Because what was very important to the professors of anthropology at that time was maintaining good relations with government. I mean, that's been a really key part of that story. So not putting government offside. Part of that has been about an attempt to ensure at various points access for researchers. Part of it has been about securing funding. But the scandal really was that Piddington had made this major critique of the treatment of Aboriginal people in part of Australia. And Elkin, A.P. Elkin, who would go on to become the professor of anthropology at Sydney in the mid-1930s and really dominate Australian anthropology for two decades, would later write to A.O. Neville and assure him that the future anthropologist that he would send to West Australia would not be like Piddington. In other words, they wouldn't create the kind of scandal, they wouldn't say the kinds of controversial things that he said about the treatment of Aboriginal people. So I think there has been a kind of a politics of, at various points, albeit in complex ways, of complicity and silence. And in the background of a lot of that is the maintenance of, or the attempt to maintain good relations with government.
So exploring marriage rules or kinship or language patterns or how to weave baskets, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But don't have a look at what happens to people on a cattle station. Don't have a look at kidnapped children. Don't have a look at exploitation.
I think that's absolutely right, David. That was the politics of the discipline for some time. I think there was a sense that what anthropology should be doing is focusing on what the Haitian American anthropologist called the savage slot. In other words, to focus on those parts of the world which had been kind of apparently, or at least this is how they were presented, untouched by colonization.
The more savage, the better.
Exactly, because that was a way in which, you know, the quote-unquote West was able to better understand itself. The history of anthropology has moved on a great deal, though I think there are still very serious questions that the discipline grapples with in terms of how it seeks to understand or make sense or explain other cultures and societies.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Michael Edwards, a lecturer in anthropology at the University of Sydney, which faculty is celebrating its centenary. Michael, A.P. Elkin, he's one of that handful of mega scholars who dominated Australian intellectual life for a long time. Tell us about him. What was his impact? Why did he have this kind of intellectual heft that counted for so much?
That's right, David. So, I mean, as I said before, Elkin really dominates Australian anthropology from 1933 when he's appointed chair. And he's really not a major theorist, in fact. And in the rest of the world, Elkin and many of the anthropologists that were trained under Elkin at the University of Sydney were not taken extremely seriously as theorists of culture and society. What they were doing, however, was in-depth ethnographic studies, and particularly here in Australia, but also in the Pacific, because the other part of all of this is that anthropology in Australia, part of the motivation for establishing anthropology in Australia is the need to produce knowledge about, in particular, New Guinea and Papua, these colonies which fall under Australian dominion in the wake of World War I. So that shapes a lot of the early development.
Because we need to know them to control them.
We need to know them to control them. And in fact, up until the end of the Second World War, colonial administrators who would go on to serve in New Guinea did a year of training at the anthropology department at Sydney. But coming back to Elkin, you know, he dominates Australian anthropology. He dominates it through these kinds of networks of patronage, and his control over, at least initially, those Rockefeller Foundation funds, which are administered through the Australian National Research Council. So he's deciding who gets those funds, where they're able to do research, and he's managing the relations with government that allow access for those anthropologists. He's also directly involved in the management of Aboriginal populations. He's the vice president of the Aborigines Protection Board of New South Wales. So he's very committed to this idea that anthropological knowledge, particularly of Indigenous populations, should be useful. It should be useful to government. It should help government manage these populations. Now, perhaps, you know, in contrast to his contemporaries, some of his views might be seen as slightly less sort of explicitly and openly racist. He was opposed to racial segregation. He was opposed to the White Australia policy. And he was in complicated ways an assimilationist.
He was an advocate for citizenship, wasn't he?
He was an advocate for citizenship, but it was still something that was grounded in a paternalistic and a civilizing mission, and he saw anthropology's role as facilitating that.
That, I gather, is no longer the attitude of anthropology. I need to leap forward a bit. Let's talk about the ethics of collection.
Mm.
Once upon a time, you just went out into the bush, you made contact of some kind with an Indigenous population, you walked into that population and said, "Tell me your secrets." It doesn't work like that anymore, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't work like that anymore. I think, you know, one product, I think, of the self-reflection that has taken place in anthropology since the 1970s, at least, if not earlier, but then right through the 1980s and through to today, I think has been that perhaps more than other disciplines, I think anthropologists tend to, that this is speaking in very sort of broad terms, take their kind of responsibilities and the ethics of their research, their responsibilities to their research interlocutors very seriously now, and think through these questions about research, about data, about data sovereignty, about how anthropologists, especially in their ethnographic writing, represent the people who they got to know, who they spent these extended periods of time with during fieldwork. So I think it's fair to say we think through those questions in a far deeper way today. I think the danger is saying that those questions have completely gone away. And I think what's really important in telling these histories of the discipline and sort of reflecting on the discipline today is to avoid what the anthropologists Brigapati Singh and Jane Geyer call an Oedipal approach to the history of anthropology.
What is that?
An Oedipal approach would be an approach to say, let's talk about how horrible all of our disciplinary forefathers and ancestors were, and narrate a story to the sort of bright, enlightened present of today. Now, I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem because not only does it get in the way of a kind of a more complex and nuanced engagement with the history of the discipline in this place and elsewhere, but I think it also lets us off the hook today when in our universities we're no less implicated in the same or similar structures of power that I think as scholars of relations we need to reckon with still.
Michael, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me, David.
I've been talking to Dr. Michael Edwards, lecturer in anthropology at the University of Sydney, that faculty has just celebrated its centenary, which has led to this thoughtful reflection on the history of anthropology in this country and its future. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, we talk to Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Albanese has just published a report on what she calls the ongoing genocide in Gaza, which she blames on influential third states that have enabled long-standing systematic violations of international law by Israel.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.